The United States has filed a civil lawsuit against Apple, and it's a big one. On this episode of the Macworld Podcast, we're talking about that case, what it's about, why it was filed, what does it mean for Apple, what does it mean for users, and more. That's on today's show. Stick around. Welcome to the Macworld Podcast. I'm Roman Loyola, here with Jason Cross.
Good morning.
And Michael Simon.
Hello, sir.
About 2 weeks ago, the United States Department of Justice filed a civil lawsuit against Apple. The suit alleges that Apple has violated Section 2 of the Sherman Act. And that's a lot to take in, so we thought we'd take this time to discuss the suit and try and get a better understanding of what's going on. But before we dive into it, I feel like I should say up front that none of us here are lawyers, so there will likely be details we simply don't know of or don't explain properly because of the legal mess of this lawsuit, I guess, or whatever, however you want to call it. Yeah, so whatever's said on the show should not be constituted as legal advice, though I doubt Apple's lawyers are looking to Macworld editors for advice on this particular suit.
You don't think so?
Well, you never know.
I also think we should mention up front that because everybody likes to take sides, people have preconceived sort of notions about this sort of stuff. They are anti-Apple or pro-Apple or Apple's. They want their side to win or something. We're not on either the government or the or Apple's side here. We're on your side, the Apple user. so there are many times in which Apple winning something is good for the users, and there are times when it's not good for the users. There's things they do that are good for you, the Apple user. There's things Apple does that is good for Apple, but not good for you. And we're going to be critical of Apple in those situations. But what we're on the user side, not Apple corporate side, not the government side.
We're Macworld. Apple was tied to Macworld for many, 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 many years through the convention, through the expo that they ran multiple times a year all around the world. Yet, you know, we have nothing to do with Apple. We're not part of them. We're not paid by them. They don't advertise with us. There's complete and total separation between us and Apple. Yet people still kind of connect us to Apple. There's a lot of people out there who see Macworld and like, oh yeah, I remember Steve Jobs announced the iPhone at Apple at Macworld. You know, so they think that we're, you know, connected.
Yeah, even if they don't remember that, newer people they message us saying like, could you tell Apple about this problem with their product? And we're like, dude, that's not how this works at all. About the closest thing we have to being related to Apple is that we're on the list of press that they work with to provide review samples for products. And that's about it, you know, and sometimes, you know, they email their responses to things like this, like the DOJ suit, when they sent out their response, they email it to places like us. That's about it.
Most news websites cover a multitude of companies and sources and events. And we are literally dedicated to Apple. So it's, you know, as Jason said, we're not taking sides, but it's hard not to, in the sense that you know, we need Apple to recognize us. As Jason said, they send us review units. So we need some level of simpatico
sometimes with we buy them.
yeah, that's true too. Sometimes we don't always get them. And, you know, it probably wouldn't affect our coverage if we did or didn't, but it's covering the company who's now being sued in a massive lawsuit by our own country's judicial system is, you know, it's interesting. <We'll
say. laughs> It puts you in a weird place, and that's why I kind of want to, before we get talking about any of what's the claims are, the merits, or any of that stuff, that's why I wanted to get up front that, like, we're not going to – Apple's not our boy, and we're not going to back them. We're going to back you, the user, and talk about just divorced from having any sort of feeling about which side should win, what the merits are of some of these things.
I've had a few people, when they find out what I do, they bring up the lawsuit. And the first question they ask me is, what's the deal with the lawsuit?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's sort of a big question. It's a big question. And a couple people I've talked to, they didn't understand that it was a civil suit, not a criminal suit. Because one person asked me, is Tim Cook going to end up going to jail? And it's like, what do you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a valid question when you hear the Department of Justice is suing a company. Sure. There's SEC violations. There's all sorts of things that Tim Cook could go to jail for. None of them are alleged in this suit.
I know there's no such thing as a quick summary for this particular lawsuit, but is there a good way to summarize this lawsuit?
When they filed the complaint, the Department of Justice files the suit, and it's some 80-something page document, but a lot of that is footnotes and all this other stuff. But they also did a quick sort of, I guess, news release that sums it up, and it has the five main complaint areas sort of highlighted. So the best way to sum it up is to say, here are the five things that they're talking about in this suit that they filed. They can go further into things when it gets to trial and all this other stuff, but this is what they named in their complaint. So they say Apple is in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act, which is the main anti-competitive antitrust law from like 1890 that's been used federally for everything since then. But also a couple of state antitrust acts, New Jersey and I think Minnesota, Wyoming, one other state or something. They're in violation of those. And the five areas are blocking innovative super apps. They say Apple has disrupted the growth of apps with broad functionality that would make it easier for consumers to switch between competing smartphone platforms. In other words, if you do all of your payments and all these other things through WeChat, then you can go to a non-Apple phone. And as long as it has WeChat, you're not like cutting yourself off from all this stuff that you've done before. Suppressing mobile cloud streaming services. Apple has blocked the development of cloud streaming apps and services that would allow consumers to enjoy high-quality video games and other cloud-based applications without having to pay for expensive smartphone hardware. Excluding cross-platform messaging apps, Apple has made the quality of cross-platform messaging worse, less innovative, and less secure for users so that its consumers will have to keep buying iPhones. That's the sort of iMessage lock-in that we hear about so much, and the bubbles and everything else. Diminishing the functionality of non-Apple smartwatches. Apple has limited the functionality of third-party smartwatches so that users who purchase the Apple Watch face substantial out-of-pocket costs if they do not keep buying iPhones. That is, number one, Apple Watch doesn't work with anything else, so if you buy one, your next phone's going to have to be an iPhone. And number two, they allow Apple Watch to do things with your iPhone that they don't allow third-party smartwatches to do, like acting on notifications and stuff. And then lastly, limiting third-party digital wallets. Apple has prevented third-party apps from offering tap-to-pay functionality, inhibiting the creation of cross-platform third-party digital wallets, and that, which is sort of self-explanatory there. Tap and pay only works in the Apple wallet. And you can't make any sort of other default wallet on your phone or anything.
I'll put a link to that summary in the show notes for our podcast. It's essentially a press release from the U.S. Department of Justice.
Our news story about this has that link, and it has that quoted, and it has the full filing. If you want to read the 80-something page PDF, it's got a link to that too.
I also do want to give the DOJ credit for correctly spelling whack-a-mole in their press release. So there are these five areas that DOJ is claiming Apple is exerting monopoly power over.
When you hear that word monopoly, you think Apple is the only person who makes smartphones, therefore they have a monopoly, and that's clearly not the case. That's not what is being alleged at all. Like, yes, Android phones exist. And yes, Android phones make up a much larger market share than iPhones do. The problem that the Department of Justice has is that, well, it's twofold. One, Apple pretty much has like that premium smartphone market locked up. And two, it's using its ecosystem as leverage to A, lock other parties out of the iPhone, and B, you know, keep its dominance in that sector. And correct me if I'm wrong on that, Jason.
There is no magic number. There's no magic market share at which you are a monopoly, and anything below that, you're not. That is not how the government defines a monopoly. The courts have defined a monopoly. The monopoly's been, and market power have been defined differently in different cases, but the Supreme Court has basically held that the definition of a monopoly is, quote, the power to control prices and exclude competition. And remember, we're talking about the U.S. here. This is a U.S. case about the United States. So the fact that Apple is 20% global market share and the rest is Android means nothing. Here, the DOJ says Apple's something like 55% of all smartphone sales and 65% of what they call premium smartphone sales. So it's more than half. It's not enough that there's no other choices out there, but it is enough, they argue, that Apple has the ability to sort of pick winners and losers in markets that are big enough to be a concern for antitrust legislation, like smartphone apps, smartwatches, smartphones themselves, so on.
Should we just go like through each of the five categories?
Just to quickly overview each one.
So the first one is the blocking super apps. Now, the funny thing about this particular category to me is, if people don't know what a super app is, they're very popular in Asian countries. I don't know if they're popular in other parts of the world, but it's essentially an app where you can basically do many different functions in that particular app.
I mean, it's kind of like iOS in its own little self-contained app. Like, you use it for messaging, for payments, for social media, for, you know, whatever, contact maps.
Yeah.
Whatever
video
it is.
Video calls.
Yeah. But it's all within an app that you launch. It's almost like a whole separate OS that launches on your phone. It's all web-based. And
yeah,
you
it's
launch
very
it
light.
And it's very, right. It's very, very lightweight. And it obviously completely changes the software experience of whatever device you're using.
Yeah, the most popular is WeChat by far, which is, of course, very popular in China and some Asian countries and stuff. And they have an integrated payment gateway called WeChat Pay, Pen Pay. There's, how can I put this? You can make purchases in physical stores and stuff with image recognition. They have like QR codes, and you can like scan something and buy and pay for it that way. So it's not just online payments like PayPal or something like that. It's actually almost like a digital wallet. It's a way for you to pay for stuff in stores and things. They do video calls. They do over-the-top text messaging stuff. There's a work chat because they, you know, for corporations and everything. So it's interesting because that obviously exists on iOS. So how are they blocking those things? And those kind of apps just haven't even proven popular at all in the US. Like, Facebook was going that way and like split off Facebook Messenger and stuff because people were like, there's too much in Facebook. But then on the other hand, Facebook still has like Facebook Marketplace built into Facebook and other stuff. So it's a strange complaint to make because on the one hand, evidence to the contrary seems to show that like they exist and it's just not popular. But on the other hand, their app store rules seem to prohibit some of the things that WeChat does. And they let WeChat slide because it's too important to them. Like the mini apps that they have within WeChat kind of fall afoul of some of the App Store guidelines, it would seem. And when other apps have tried this sort of thing, they don't get approved. But WeChat gets away with it. And it's they're toeing a line. It's like it's narrow there, right? So if you take WeChat away, are they really stopping this? And if the government's claiming this, the weird thing is they've been investigating since 2019. So they've got 5 years of digging. They have emails, they have receipts. They're going to bring up in court, like, here, look, this is when this executive emailed this other executive and said, hey, if we allow apps to do all this stuff, then their people are tied to the app and they can go buy a cheap Android phone and use this app and not have to buy an iPhone, right? They wouldn't be making this, they wouldn't be had this included in their suit if they didn't have some sort of evidence like that. So I think that's going to be one of those ones that's going to be interesting to see what comes up when this actually starts going to court, if it goes to court.
I would be shocked if it didn't, but yeah, it's possible that they settle this before it reaches court.
In reading the court filing, and this is my interpretation, the court filing is interesting to read because it's most court filings are written, you know, a lot of legalese. It's very, you know, if you ever read lawyer speak, it's usually like that. But this is written as a narrative almost. It's written to be more friendly to the general population, to everyone else. It also has a certain tone to it, and it makes it sound like if it weren't for Apple's machinations, super apps would be successful on the iPhone. When my interpretation is people in the U.S. just don't use them, and that's why they're not popular.
Yeah, they don't want them.
Yeah, and there's no indication that Facebook or Meta dropped that plan because of the iPhone. I think they dropped the plan because consumers didn't respond to it in the way that they thought they would.
So it's good. Yeah, that's going to be one that's interesting to watch. It's also true that the Department of Justice is not limited to only suing Apple over the things that are still happening. Apple can have changed policies, and they can still sue them over the stuff they used to do.
And they like, did you can't change just, some things this year already.
Yeah, you can't just put your thumb on the scale and get success and then take your thumb off the scale and say, hey, look, you know, no harm, no foul, like obviously.
But it could affect any potential punishment or
fees, yeah, remedy,
whatever comes,
yeah, whatever
comes after all this, because they've already made changes and there's more coming after this whole EU. Most of them are overseas, but there are some changes being made here as well. And iOS 18 is coming out in a few months. We'll see what that brings. So, you know, Apple has seen the writing on the wall for some time with all these things.
So another issue that the DOJ is in their filing is about suppressing mobile cloud streaming services.
They have prohibited for all this time game streaming services like Xbox Cloud Streaming, GeForce Now. Amazon had, what was it, Luna? what was the Google one they killed, like a million services? Stadia.
Stadia, yeah.
Yeah. Those things couldn't exist on the phone. Apple said the reason is because all the games that you could play in there need their own listings in the App Store and everything. And that just kind of didn't jibe with the exceptions they carved out for video streaming services, which have a whole different set of rules around monetization and what you're allowed to do and everything. And because they need that, they can't have.
Obviously, you know, Netflix is the biggest one that we're talking about here.
Yeah, that's where most of that started. I mean, the whole splintering of a million different streaming services is relatively recent, but they carved out all these exceptions in the App Store for video streaming services years ago, basically because, well,
they had to.
They had to,
or
the iPhone was going to be the only smartphone without Netflix, right?
However, you still can't sign up for a Netflix membership through the Netflix app on an iPhone. Like, but that, we'll get into that. That's one of the other points.
Apple has this year changed their policy about cloud gaming services, saying that like the app that you would use to access it just has to have the listings in the App Store for the most restrictive game they provide access to and stuff. So it has to be M-rated or whatever, you know. And so far, nobody's launched on it, and that's because a lot of their payment stuff still hasn't changed. They still can't, you still can't sign up for or buy games directly within those streaming services and stuff without having going through Apple's payment systems and giving Apple 30% and all that stuff. So far, even though they've changed that, and even though companies like Microsoft have been like arguing that that Apple needs to change it, they haven't launched their services on it because the payment stuff is still kind of a no-go for them.
The just to inject a bit, the cloud gaming thing, to me, it would be very easy for Apple to just allow it because it works through a cloud. It's just a simple, it's basically a website that launches. The hardware is more than capable of running any of these games. They have tons of users, tons of fans, tons of iPhone users that would love to have this without, you know, needing to pay for another service. They probably pay for it on Xbox or wherever already.
Yeah, yeah.
Yet Apple cuts it off basically because of money. Like, there's no other reason why it would. It's not a hardware requirement. It's not a Wi-Fi requirement. It's because they would miss out on a bunch of 30% fees, really.
Right. And when they did allow it, as they do now, they still have rules that if you launch the Xbox One, which you can do on an iPhone in a web browser, it's just not as good an experience. It's like looking at an Xbox's home screen almost. It only shows the games you can stream, but you can buy them there and stuff. If you don't have access, you can buy them there. If you don't have Game Pass, you can buy Game Pass there. So, and Apple's like, no. If you're going to do that, it has to go through our payments and our, you know, and we want our 30%. Other stuff. They're like, well, there's not 30% of margin in this. We don't have that to give. We're not doing it. Forget it. And the same goes with things like GeForce Now. And there's a reason those things haven't appeared, even though they've kind of lifted the rule. And it's about, like you said, the payment stuff. But it's more than just games. Games is the obvious one. The worry, and I think some of the evidence that the DOJ might have in emails and stuff, is that they're worried about cloud apps and stuff too. I think one of the emails they quoted in the DOJ thing, they're worried about you basically having cloud-based phone operating system that you can go buy some cheap $25 Android phone and stream apps from the cloud that are running well. And now why do you need to buy a $500 iPhone? Yeah, they're just as worried about any old app, and Apple does not those things. The closest they allow is virtual desktop apps for like your Windows machine or something. And that's not for cloud service in the cloud Windows machines. That's for your own desktop computer. You can still do that. That's going to be an interesting one. That's another one where I'm curious to see what sort of dirt they've dug up from Apple over the years.
Probably the one issue that users could probably relate to the most is the excluding cross-platform messaging apps issue that the DOJ has made as part of its filing. This is the whole Blue Bubbles messaging thing.
Yeah, this is a perfect example of where we need to remember this is about the United States, because worldwide, this is not an issue. People are just using a million other over-the-top messaging services, whether it's Facebook chat or WeChat or everything else in most places. But in the US, SMS and iMessage and things like that are strong, sticky elements of the iPhone. And it's tied very deeply to sort of people's purchase choices here in the US in a way that it isn't globally.
Yeah, because that summary line of the summary that says excluding cross-platform messaging apps, if you just take it like that, that's actually not true. You can use WeChat. You can use, what's the other one? I can't remember what the other.
WhatsApp Signal.
WhatsApp is the biggest, which of course Meta owns. Here's where, if I was the DOJ, the point I would make about this is Apple has theirs, their over-the-top messaging service, pre-installed on every phone. It's the same app that's used to do text messaging, and you're automatically enrolled and signed in, right? You just, if you just message another iPhone, it's an iMessage. Like, you don't choose. It's the messages app that you use to send texts. And it, so they're inherently tying their over-the-top messaging service and the app to do it into the core functionality of the phone, the SMS messaging. And they don't let anyone else do that. I can't download, you know, WeChat or something like that as I can on Android phones. Those apps can be your SMS app. They can text people if they don't have WeChat. They don't allow that on iPhones, and they don't allow anybody else. Obviously, nothing else can be pre-installed, and they don't ask you, hey, do you want to use iMessage or some other over-the-top messaging service? Like, you get it. So that would be my argument about what they mean by excluding others, right?
So is that kind of similar to the idea of the DOJ Microsoft case years ago, where you had to use Internet Explorer?
They brought that up about Internet Explorer a lot. The details are different because Microsoft doesn't sell. They license Windows to PC manufacturers who pre-install it on computers, and they were kind of forcing them and stuff. But yes, that is the closest thing to what Microsoft got in trouble for before. Is this isn't one of their five main points, but they brought up sort of web browsers and stuff in the full document. And Apple does some of that as well with like Safari. They don't, no other browser can be pre-installed. They don't allow
no other browser, and it's all WebKit. So even if you download Chrome, you're basically downloading Safari with a different interface.
Right. You get your all the non-browser stuff, all the non-web rendering stuff, like your browser histories and stuff like that, sync with your other Chrome devices. Right. But you don't get to. Yeah, and that's changed in the EU, and they have a browser ballot, and it's almost like Apple went out of their way to make the browser ballot as ugly and terrible as possible because it looks awful.
Shocking.
But they can use their own browser engines and stuff like that in compliance with the EU's Digital Market Act.
Yeah, and I've read a lot of these kind of, you know, responses that say, well, why wouldn't I want to use iMessage? And that might be true. But that's not the complaint here. It's not that Apple iMessage is so great. It's that they're shutting down anything that might compete with it because they want to keep you locked into to messages.
By doing that and by not making iMessage available on a competing phones, your next phone's got to be an iPhone. That's where they say they're leveraging their antitrust thing. If they allowed WhatsApp to use to send SMSs, and you could install WhatsApp, say, I want this to be my default SMS application, and delete Apple's Messages app. Well, now, if your whole messaging history is in there, your next phone can be an Android phone, and you're not going to miss all your history will be there. You're not going to miss anything. You're not going to be able to not get anything. Whereas all your iMessages would be gone.
And, you know, listen, iMessage is excellent. It's probably the best message service out there. But
it's great. Every time I go look at WeChat, I'm like, why is this popular? It looks like it's from 1987. What is going on with this interface? Like, it is great, and it definitely solved – when it was new, it solved a huge problem.
Apple will be implementing RCS in iOS 18.
Or maybe 18.1. You know, this could be one of those things that's it's an update. That'll help. But it's still true that there are going to be green bubbles. You're not going to get to choose. Well, you have to go out of your way to choose not to do it. But like, if you have an iPhone and you just message some other iPhone, it's going to be an iMessage. It's going to be a blue bubble. And if you switch to some other phone, all of those are gone. That whole message history is gone. You can't take that with you.
Another issue is the diminishing functionality of non-Apple smartwatches.
These last two points that the DOJ makes feel like the slam dunk cases to me. These feel like the ones they have the best clear evidence for, right? Because Apple's under no obligation to make an Apple Watch work with Android, which would allow people who buy an Apple Watch to switch phones. But they implemented APIs in iOS the year before the Apple Watch launched, for smartwatches, right? They had all these frameworks for smartwatches. And they did all this stuff. And then the next year they launched Apple Watch and they, quote, upgraded all of those APIs, the new version of iOS, and they added all these features, but they also limited all these important and necessary features, like the ability to actually react to a notification, right? You can get notifications on a third-party smartwatch, but you can't like tap on it, send a reply or anything like that. You can't do any of that. There's like a bunch of technical examples of that kind of thing where they allow Apple Watch to do things and they don't have frameworks for other smartwatches to do those things. There is something to be said for, hey, this works best because we control the ecosystem. But it's another thing to say like, well, but we're deliberately kind of hamstringing other things. And the fact that they had these abilities and pulled them right when they launched Apple Watch is really suspect.
The other quote unquote slam dunk topic is delimiting third-party digital wallets. This is so you can use something other than Apple Pay, I'm assuming?
There are no tap-to-pay services that aren't Apple Pay. That can be somebody's default tap-to-pay solution. I'm sure PayPal and everybody else would love that if I go to the store and I buy something with my MasterCard, that they want to process that transaction. And you can't do that. It's got to be Apple's wallet app, Apple's wallet API, and Apple Pay. It is possible to launch apps and do them with other stuff, but when you go to a Square terminal at your hairdresser and tap your iPhone, that's Apple Pay. They have limited and prohibited that for quite some time. That's another area that they've had to change in the EU to comply with the Digital Markets Act. And it's another area where, as a user, I don't want 15 different wallets. I don't want PayPal to have its own wallet app with its own like payment services and its partners in it, and they're not somewhere else. And then next thing I know, I've got 5 different wallet apps on my phone, and I don't love that. But I also don't love the idea that like physical real world goods purchasing that have nothing to do with apps or anything else, like just being a plumber, or not have to go through Apple's payment processing, right? That feels like, as they said, like sort of very exclusionary. I that's one of those arguments where that doesn't really hinder competition or lock people in to the iPhone, the users. That's more about developers and other payment processors and stuff like that. That's like anti-competitive to them because there's nothing stopping me from adding my credit cards to an Android phone and tapping and paying with a different payment processor there when I go buy stuff.
That's a summary of the 5 issues that the DOJ is pursuing. This lawsuit's probably going to take a few years to...
All of these things will go to trial together and stuff. But it's possible that the verdict is they're guilty of A, C, and D and not, you know, B and E, right? Like it's not all or none.
The DOJ has not made any suggestions or demands for what it wants as a result of this lawsuit.
Yeah, that's not how this works. The number one thing I see on sort of social media and stuff when people discuss this is, well, what do they want Apple to do? And it's like, well, that's not how the DOJ doesn't decide that. They might suggest something to the court after something's found, after findings made, but no, they argue that they've broken the law. The court will decide after, you know, a discovery and a million other, you know, like you said, 2 years of legal wrangling. The court will decide. And then the court gets to decide what the judiciary gets to decide what the appropriate thing is. And it can be monetary settlements, especially for something that Apple has already changed policy. They've already changed. That might prohibit them from making a certain policies in the future, or they may demand technical changes, much like the EU did with the Digital Markets Act. Now, the Digital Markets Act was a new piece of legislation that was passed. So that's not quite the same thing as a court imposing a remedy to say you're not in compliance with the law. That's like a new law. And of course, the US could shut this whole thing down by passing laws that say, hey, everybody's required to do X, Y, and Z, and then Apple's got to do it. So there's many angles at which this could happen. But Apple can't just change its policies and its technology and then get off scot-free. They would probably, the government continue to say, well, yeah, but they did this stuff for years and they at least need to pay a fine.
There's a school of thought that says the main thing behind this entire case is that the Department of Justice, the U.S. government, wants Apple to give them the keys to iOS, in the sense, create a backdoor to every phone that is sold, every iPhone that is sold. We've been through this with the San Bernardino case many, many years ago, where they tried to get into the suspect's phone, and Apple gave them what they could, which was, you know, basically the
cloud stuff,
but not messages and et cetera, et cetera. And that, and you know, you could argue that had Apple been forced back then, or maybe just willingly did it, given the government a encryption key or whatever it is, to allow them to get into an iPhone when they needed to, that we wouldn't have reached this point.
That argument doesn't make as much sense to me, because it's not a remedy for any of these problems.
Right.
And
but they can't, the DOJ can't charge them with not supplying a backdoor. They can't charge them with all of this other stuff.
Right, because there's no law, right?
Right. Yeah. That's
yeah, that's the idea that this is argument. Revenge. This is revenge for San Bernardino. That doesn't strike me as, all this stuff has merit, legal merit on its own grounds, that it doesn't seem, that seems wonky to me, that would be the thing. What struck me about this is where they didn't mention things that seem like a more obvious anti-competitive things that Apple has done, right? Like, they didn't go after Apple launching its own video streaming service, building it into its video streaming app pre-installed on every phone, giving people free trials and so on. Like, they didn't, like, where did that come from? Like, they didn't, the music thing, like, they bought a music streaming app. They bought Beats, and they, which had a music streaming app, shut down Beats, did the interface and some and made it into their own music streaming service, built it into the music app that's allowed to be called music. Like, they don't allow anybody else's app to be just like a generalized word, but theirs all are. Like, you can't make an app called Notes. Like, even if
Mail, all of
it. Right. So even ones that Apple doesn't already have, you can't name your app web browser or something, but Apple could. Right, if they wanted. So they say they did that, and they pre-installed it on all their phones, and they can send you like notifications and stuff for free trials. Even if you've never chosen, I didn't choose Apple Music, I didn't want it, I didn't install it, but my phone's offering me a free trial, and the app's already on my phone. And how is that fair to Spotify and YouTube Music and Amazon Music and those things, which can't do any of that. And this is not something that was inherent to the iPhone. They had iTunes, they split it off into the music and podcast app and stuff like that, but it was about a storefront and playing your own music, right? It's weird to me that they didn't go down any of those kind of routes or name any of that kind of stuff in the suit, which seems like bigger and more obvious anti-competitive stuff.
So the case doesn't specifically mention Spotify or any of these, but they do all stand to benefit if it goes the right way. Like, all of these apps, Netflix, obviously Epic, Spotify, like the bigger apps who have been making a lot of noise, well, Netflix not so much, but they would still, I'm sure, like to offer, you know, their own payment system for signing up for subscriptions through the app. All the apps that have been, you know, really kind of hammering pounding this drum that says, hey, we are at a distinct disadvantage on the iPhone because Apple offers a competing service, because we can't link to our website that has payment terms, because we can't offer alternative methods of payment, because we can't do, you know, cloud gaming, all these reasons, whatever the outcome here is, they all stand to benefit in a big way.
The biggest thing, again, absent from this is sort of all the App Store payment lock-in stuff. That's not really part of this. Like, that's not really listed as part of this. We don't know what, if found to be in violation, we don't know what the remedies will be imposed by the court. So it's possible that we might see something more like what's being done in the EU, where they have to allow sideloading, they have to allow other app stores. But that's not, that the app store stuff just isn't even part of this. It's almost shocking to me. But your point about who's cheering the DOJ on for this, yeah, it's a lot, all the people who've been making noise, but even people who don't compete in any way with Apple, like Consumer Reports issued a statement that said that in support of the suit and said, Apple has been an outlier in its willingness to make changes to products and services to the benefit of consumers and developers. We've seen Apple limit access to hardware and software for competing services and products like smartwatches and contactless payments, and that's harmed innovation and competition. Apple claims to be a champion of protecting user data, but its App Store fee structure and partnership with Google Search erode privacy. We applaud the Justice Department's action against Apple today. It's critical that the U.S. join regulators and competition authorities worldwide to make Apple change the way it does business. Consumer Reports doesn't, they probably have an app, but they're not in any way really.
They don't see Apple's ecosystem as a revenue generator for them, as a primary revenue generator.
Yeah, but they're advocating for the consumer.
Right.
And, you know, all of these claims, all of these accusations, taken at face value, they all affect and hurt the consumer. Anytime there's a lack of competition, I mean, we could look at Ticketmaster, which I don't quite understand why they haven't been sued by the government, but you know,
that's underway. Remember how they've been doing?
Yes,
they've been researching this since investigating since 2019. They're investigating Ticketmaster, and their day is coming.
Yeah, yeah. At some point, they will be brought in front of a court. But you know, you can talk to anyone who's bought tickets to a show, whether it's Taylor Swift or a college basketball game, and say like, yeah, it's terrible. We're getting, you know, fees on top of fees on top of fees, and then we get sent to a third party, overpriced, basically a scalping system that they also own. So
yeah, I know.
like you could look there and see how bad it can get. Now, Apple has generated a ton of trust with the people that buy its products, and there's a lot of people, and we're probably among them, the people listening to this podcast and the people talking on the podcast, that believe, you know, Apple would never do anything directly to hurt the consumer. But the line that's drawn there by the government, you know, it makes sense, where if you keep doing these things and piling this on top of this on top of this on top of this, eventually, you know, Apple's argument that says, well, you know, we're the safest and we make the best stuff and everyone's fine. Like, eventually you have to say, well, then, okay, if that's true, if the iPhone is so great and you believe in iOS, and why are you locking everybody out of it just to promote your own stuff?
Or preventing others from competing on even terms,
right.
That is the two sides to every sort of antitrust thing, is demonstrating consumer harm and demonstrating harm to competition. And here in the United States, in the last decade or two, the outcomes of antitrust cases have hinged on that consumer harm bit. That used to be a great metric 30, 40 years ago, whatever. But in today's economy, that is very, very hard to pin anybody on, because so much stuff is quote unquote free. So like, if you're going to give away something for free, and it's ad supported or whatever, it doesn't matter if you're squashing every competing service that could be better and also free or whatever. How are you going to show customer harm? How are you going to show that, like, consumers paid more when it's all free? Or you can't argue in court some hypothetical, yes, but the free competing service would be better. Like, you don't know. That's not a legal defense. And Apple's services, whether it's Apple Music or iCloud storage or Apple TV. They're not like way more expensive. They're pretty much comparably priced. So showing consumer harm in the economic sense is going to be really hard to nail Apple on. And I think that government's case is really going to have to hinge on showing economic harm to developers and just anti-competitive, like that they're squashing competition. That has not been what most antitrust cases have been won or lost on recently in recent history. So it's going to be really interesting to see where this goes. I just want to ask from you guys, what do you want Apple to have to do or to end up doing or whatever? Like what do you think is going to be best for Apple users?
As someone who is, I think I would say I'm fully invested in Apple's ecosystem. I don't have any problems with the way it is right now. So I only see the fix. I only see this DOJ case as things can get a little better, but I don't know. It's hard for me to say right now if it'll have a big influence on how I use my Apple products. Like, I have no desire to leave the ecosystem. I have no desire to use an Android phone.
And you don't see personally about how if it was easier for people to switch or easier for people, then Apple would have to compete differently. Apple would have to be more competitive on price, on features, on something. That's not really part of your life, part of your decision.
The concerns I have are more on the developer side, like the 30% cut and things like that. Those are the issues that I wish would change. The usability stuff that the DOJ is approaching, you know, I don't play streaming video games, so I don't miss that on my phone. I know a lot of users would like that, but in terms of my own personal use case, I have a hard time seeing the DOJ suit changing the way I use Apple products or technology in general, because I would still be invested in the Apple ecosystem regardless.
I think that's true of a lot of people, probably the three of us. But I also think that by keeping such a tight lock on the way the iPhone operates, it's stifled innovation, both within and without Apple, because like the word monopoly is most applicable in the sense that when you buy an iPhone, you're using an iPhone, and that's it. You got to buy everything from the App Store. You have to go through the Apple's payment system to buy, you know, in-app purchase it like this. I would rather, you know, let's use Spotify. I'd rather have the choice to share my library to, you know, buy whether it's a subscription or an in-app purchase without wondering if I'm being charged 20% more because Apple's charging 30% to the developer to allow that. I'd much rather be able to have a browser other than Safari that runs a browser engine that's other than WebKit. Like, you know, the iPhone is a fantastic device, yet I'm very conscious when I use it that there's a lot more that it could be doing that I'm not allowed to do on it. When I set up my Mac, it's a completely different feeling that I have because I know if I download Chrome, it's a different experience than if I download Safari and I'm able to decide. I use Safari. I have Chrome installed and sometimes I do go to it, but it's my choice to use Safari. On the iPhone, I've never really used Opera or Safari or because there's no point. Like, I don't care. It's the same browser engine. I'm not going to get any more speed. I'm not going to get many more features.
Yeah, I do have to wonder sometimes. I mean, we talk a lot about how the Apple Watch has been having very minor updates for years now.
Yeah.
The hardware capabilities, not the OS stuff. And I have to wonder if for the last 5 years now, Google and Samsung and stuff, if they were able to make a smartwatch that would work with your iPhone as well as the Apple Watch does, that would provide all the same capabilities and services, and they did that, would the Apple Watch be better today? Because they have to compete with those? Like, because they have to compete with, you know, a Pixel Watch or a Samsung Watch? Would we have a round Apple Watch? Would I have a better option? I like my Apple Watch. I wear it, use it every day. But would it be a better Apple Watch if they've had competition for smartwatches on the iPhone? And we can't ever know that. That's the trick with antitrust laws. When competition is squashed, you never know what the world would be like if that competition would be there. But my general take on it is, I think it would be a good thing, whether it was forced by the government or chosen to do by Apple, that the iPhone work more like the Mac.
Yeah.
And Apple and some of Apple's fans will often argue that if we have to do all these things, we're no different than an Android. They want to turn us into Android. That's the thing you keep saying. And that just sounds like the stupidest thing to me. That's like saying a Mac is a Windows computer.
It's a PC, right?
Right? And it's not. And they had a years-long marketing campaign telling you it wasn't. And it wasn't because of any of the stuff that locks it down, because it's not. It's not locked down. It's about the different ways it works and looks and its integration with the hardware and all that other stuff. And they could still do all that on the iPhone while being as permissive as the Mac is, right?
Yeah.
So I think no matter who ends up making it happen, whether it's the European Union's regulatory bodies or U.S. Department of Justice, or they're facing antitrust suits in places like Japan and stuff like that, like, however this shakes out, I think Apple turning the iPhone into a slightly more Mac-like sense of permissiveness and customizability control would be good. And it would still be an iPhone. It wouldn't be the Apple Android phone.
Yeah. And let's, you know, not forget, this is all about money. Apple services. Yeah,
for everyone on all sides.
So when the Mac became the Mac, which was 30 years ago, 40 years ago, none of this stuff really came into play. Yes, there was software. You had to buy it separately. Mm-hmm. Since the iPhone introduced, one, the App Store, and two, in-app purchases, Apple services revenue is like, what was the latest, $30 billion, $20, $25 billion, something like that.
Right.
That's like, you know, that's more than most companies make in a year. And that's just like a quarter for like a small slice of Apple's, you know, juggernaut. And the majority of that, it's not because people are buying Apple TV Plus subscriptions in droves. It's in-app purchases. That's the biggest one. All these little things that we buy, 99 cents in Candy Crush, a couple dollars for whatever game you're playing, they all add up because they have billions of users. And it's, you know, they're going to fight this every step of the way. And the reason why is because it's going to affect their bottom line. That's just it. I don't think they would lose if they opened it up. Let's say it became exactly like Android. They had to open up everything, even though Android is not as open as everyone thinks. But let's say they had to mirror it. They're not going to lose that many iPhone users. 1%, maybe 2%. Like, that's about it. People love their iPhones, and that's the way it's going to be. But they would lose a ton of money from those billions of in-app purchases that people make every year. And that's the difference. That's the biggest difference here.
My question is, would that extra permissiveness give iPhone apps and stuff like that, would more developers do more on their would the apps be better? Would it be the case where after a few years of that, when people move in, would iPhones be more desirable? Like, how many more iPhones would they need to sell to make up the difference in what they're losing on the App Store? But again, like, it's so weird that the DOJ stuff is—it's not about the App Store. Like, it's not. That's not even one of the things.
Right. Right.
Yeah. It's almost strange that they're not. Maybe they're not tackling that because Epic just lost on a similar case in court, and there's a lot of crossover, and they don't want to. Apple would just be like, they're just relitigating this same thing again, even though it's like slightly different. You know.
My guess is, however this ends up, that will be part of the decision, like whether it's overt or whether it's like a subtext. Like that, like that's all at the heart of this.
Yeah.
But we're looking at years. I mean, this isn't going to happen this year. It's not going to happen next year. We're probably looking at 2026, maybe. I mean, how long did the Samsung design case go on before that was settled?
This will probably get decided next year, appealed into the year after that, and then whatever remedies are imposed will have a deadline of at least a year out, because you've got to give Apple time to make changes to policy and software and stuff like that. So if any changes that come as a direct result of this are 2028, like, what's more likely to happen for users is that Apple makes some get off our back changes that are less severe than what the government might impose, but in the hopes that they're able to get the government to drop its case by saying, like, look, we made changes to satisfy you, especially if there are changes in the Department of Justice. We got an election coming up and Congress can change. And regardless of what happens in this case, Congress can pass laws. And the Department of Justice, if things change at the Department of Justice, they could drop the case.
We didn't get into any of that, but there's also political motivations at play here, as is most things that happen in this country. Yeah.
So between now and the next 3 years, the most likely outcome for users of Apple's products is that Apple makes small targeted changes to try to prevent sort of further action from antitrust regulators and stuff like that across the globe, right? That's where you're likely to see most changes actually coming. It's directly from Apple, not as a result of, not like the EU's DMA, which passed a couple of years ago and just went into effect.
Once those go into effect, as we see with the EU already, Apple will do everything it can to make sure that they obey the letter of the law and not the spirit of the law.
They're going to do the bare minimum required.
Well, that does it for this episode of the Macworld Podcast, episode 879. Thanks to Jason Cross.
Thank you.
Thanks to Michael Simon.
Thank you, sir.
And thanks to you, the audience. Thank you for tuning in. You can subscribe to the Macworld Podcast in the podcast app, on Spotify, or through any other podcast app. If you have any comments or questions, send us an email at podcast@macworld.com or contact us through X, that's at Macworld, or on Threads, that's at Macworld_HQ, or on the Macworld Facebook page. Join us in the next episode of the Macworld Podcast as we talk about the latest in the world of Apple. See you next time.